Before we begin, we'd like to ask a favor. If you could take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we'd really appreciate it. We're told it helps the show find new listeners. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the BRB podcast. This is the fourth episode of series two. In this series, we invite writers to read from their work and discuss the short story form, their writing process, how they got published, and what they're reading. The BRB podcast is a project from Brick Lane Bookshop. I'm Kate Ellis, and tonight I'm with my co-host, Peter J. Coles.
Hello.
Today, we are talking to Jess Walter about his superb collection, The Angel of Rome, which is, of course, available to buy from Brick Lane Bookshop. Keep listening for a discount code.
Jess Walter is the author of six novels, including The Financial Lives of the Poets and The Cold Millions. Beautiful Ruins was a New York Times bestseller, and We Live in Water was one of Barack Obama's books of 2019. Jess Walter lives in Spokane, Washington, with his family.
Today we're meeting on Zoom. I'm in Hackney, Peter's in Crystal Palace, Jess is in Spokane, Washington. So please excuse the odd wobble in our audio. Today we are extraordinarily lucky to be joined by Jess Walter, who is, like, believe it or not, the first ever New York Times bestselling author we've had on this podcast. But he's agreed to join us today, and we're very happy about it. And we're going to begin the episode by asking Jess to read from his story Drafting. Are you ready, Jess? Hello and welcome, by the way.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. Thanks. Yes, I think I'm ready. Drafting. Afterward, she drove past bars, restaurants, coffee shops, the library. She crossed the river back and forth. She drove past her apartment in Brown's, and finally she parked outside the baby bar. And that's when she decided to call Boone. She fingered the screen, but before she could call him, the phone buzzed and the word mom flashed. She let it go to voicemail. She had erased Boone's contact information in a fit almost a year ago, but she had the number memorized. Two rings. Hey there, he said. Long time no fuck. I need to see you, she said. I like to hear that. Then she told him. Ah, oh, shit, Boone said. He met her at the baby bar. He hugged her and she lost her breath when his arms roped around her. They ordered. Beers came, but when he reached for his wallet, he came up empty. Ah, oh, shit, Myra. It's okay, she said. I got it. She paid with a 10 and they took their cans of Rainier to a booth. The baby bar was empty and dark. She loved the place, best juke in town. Look, whatever the doctors say, do it, he said. Just do your fucking treatment, whatever it takes. When it's over, me and you will go on a trip. Go where? America. We're in America, Boone. You know what I mean. We'll just go. What about Carla? I really think it should just be the two of us. She laughed. You know what I mean. This has got nothing to do with Carla. You and I going on a trip has nothing to do with your wife. Not this time. Boone's hair was long again. Curly in front, the way she liked it. He ran his hand through it, pushed it back, but it fell forward over his eyes. I always liked your hair like that. Shit. He riffled his hair again. I'm an old shoe. She smiled. What's that mean? Most of what I say don't mean anything. He waved for another beer, then seemed to remember he didn't have any money. It's okay, she said. I got it. He was 12 years older than her, 36. His birthday was April 9. His favorite food was tacos. He still rode a skateboard. He worked in construction for his uncle, who was a concrete finisher. Boone built the wooden forms. He said that in an earlier time, he would have made his living as an outdoorsman. But it seemed to Myra that his idea of being outdoors was to buy a case of beer, drive into the woods, build a fire, and sleep in his car. He had been on and off with Carla for a decade. They had a little boy together, Dylan. Boone and Carla happened to be off, or so he said, when he met Myra in a bar almost 4 years ago. That night, she couldn't look away from him. He had thick brows and a dent above his cheek from a fight he didn't remember. People always said he looked like a younger, scruffier version of a famous actor, but they could never come up with the name, even though it was obvious to her. After they broke up, she watched Clive Owen movies and wondered if two people could look more alike and be more different. Isn't there a good kind and a bad kind? He asked her now. Yes, she said. But that was all she said about it. Shit, Myra, I'm sorry. He looked down at the beer can again. He seemed to see something in the beer, her future, maybe. Are you high, Boone? Oh, yeah. The surgeon seemed pleased with himself. The second week of radiation, she didn't think it would be so bad dying. She woke next to the toilet. She couldn't breathe. Everything was on fire, spinning. She clutched at her hair and it came out in a fistful. She retched fire like lava through her esophagus. Each jagged breath was a prayer. Please don't puke. Please don't puke. Her stomach buckled, but nothing came up. She gagged and a dribble of bile fell from her lip. She spat, panted, spat, panted. One time with Boone, she'd had a bad reaction to shrooms and vodka and had been up all night vomiting, but that was like a warm bath compared to this. Myra? Her mother stood in the doorway. She panted over the toilet. Her mother set a glass of water on the floor. Thank you. Her mother's eyes drifted to the clump of hair on the floor. There's a nurse on 24 hours I can call. I'm fine. She sipped at the water, but it was like lighter fluid going down. Her mom set something else on the ground next to her, her phone. You left this upstairs. On the screen, it said message and Boone's phone number. Myra, I hope you're not getting back into it with him. Mom, do you remember how unhealthy that whole time was for you? Of course I do. I just wanted to tell someone. He's checking to see how the surgery went. She waited until her mother went back to bed to open the message. Before this, the last time she heard from Boone was more than a year ago, when she'd texted to tell him she'd gotten into law school, and he texted back a blurry picture of his dick. He'd typed, "Your witness, counselor," misspelling counselor so badly it took her a minute to get the joke. When they were together, he had teased her about wanting to be a lawyer. He said he was using her not for sex, but for future legal representation. Now, lying on the floor, sick, she opened the new text. It was a blurry picture of his ass. He'd written, "Thinking of you." The last treatment nearly wiped her out. She slept for 2 days afterward. When she woke, she imagined the terrible heartburn was the cancer itself, even though she knew better. But it was helpful to have some feeling, this burning, to think of as the cancer. It hurt more than she could imagine was possible, like someone pulling a hot wire brush up and down her esophagus. She wanted water, but water made it worse. She wanted milk, but milk made it worse. This is cancer. This is love. This is everything. It makes it worse. She slept in the basement of her parents' house. She'd given up her apartment downtown right after she was diagnosed. Her dad must have taken care of the lease because she never heard from the landlord. This was her father's way, the old litigator working behind the scenes. He would deal with her surgeon, her oncologist, her landlord, her supervisor at the law firm where she'd worked as a paralegal, her advisor at Gonzaga. All taken care of. This was her dad's way. Take care of everything but her. While her parents were both at their offices, Myra went upstairs and watched TV. But by mid-afternoon, she'd make her way back downstairs into the guest room. The rest of the night, she'd pretend to sleep. She'd hear her mother's footsteps on the carpeted staircase and then in the doorway, and she'd breathe heavily in the dark until her mother went back upstairs. Then she'd hear her father talk to Myra's mother, and the rest of the evening would be noises from upstairs. Phone ringing, doorbell, dinner dishes, TV, the creak of her father's shoes. Morning and her mother's light steps on the stairs again. Myra? I made a quiche. Are you hungry? No. You should eat. I'll have some cereal later. Her mother came over, sat on the bed, and put her hand on Myra's forehead. Myra puffed out a little laugh. Are you checking to see if I have a fever? Think I should stay home from school? Her mother laughed too and then covered her mouth. Oh, baby, she said, her voice cracking into tears. I don't know what else to do. I know, Mom. Myra sat up. She reached over and put her hand on her mother's forehead. I don't know what to do either.
Thank you so much. That was
thank you.
A real, it's great hearing stories read aloud.
Just the best. That's something. I always say this, but it's just so interesting to hear you read it, because something else comes out in the story when you read it. When you read your own work, obviously, something else comes out. And like, I really felt
more, even more for Myra than I did the first time I read it myself. It's just, yeah, it was wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I always, for some reason, just love that character and her turning to probably the worst person in her life, but, you know, just the one that maybe can lurch her back to life at that really difficult moment.
Yeah. I think everybody should now go buy this book and finish the story because it gets really good.
It gets really good.
Yeah, it gets really good. Loved
there's
it.
There's a tape deck and a road trip.
It's fascinating.
Six choice 90s beer. Tunes.
Yeah. Yes, some choice 90s tunes. Exactly.
I didn't think anyone else listened to Blind Melon, but apparently they did.
I was just imagining that tape case that you used to have in your car at that time, you know, and since we stopped listening to tapes, it's as if time froze at that moment, you know. I mean, I don't have any tapes from the aughts. They sort of stopped in 1995. And so imagine you bought this old car and that's all it has was just brilliant for and a fun thing to think about.
So today we're talking about your new collection, The Angel of Rome. And I was wondering to begin with whether you would mind describing the collection as a whole to for our listeners, if that's possible at all.
Yeah. It, you know, The Angel of Rome is a dozen stories written over about a 7-year period when I felt like I was coming into my own as a story writer, and I was making a conscious effort to write in different voices to sort of expand, you know, the qualities that I thought made a great short story. So one of the things that I'm maybe proudest of that is maybe the least of its time thing about the book is that it's not about one person's identity. It's really, I hope, an exercise in empathy to capture stories like Myra's, to capture an old man watching kids out on the curb outside his house, to capture a young girl in a story called Mr. Voice, who grows up with a beautiful mother who tells her she's going to have to spend her looks one day like a bank account, and how that echoes through her life as she's raised by the stepfather, to the title story, The Angel of Rome, which takes me back to beautiful ruins, which is probably what a lot of readers know me for, and those sort of twin themes of Hollywood and dreams and ambition and Italy, which is one of my favorite places to go, which I've just gotten back from. And so, like I think my other story collection, We Live in Water, it really, when I look back at short stories, there for me, there's so much a reflection of what I was thinking and writing and imagining during that period. And I think it's one of the things I'm proudest of is the real diversity and variety of stories within the book, and a lot of which reflect what I was going through at the time. My father, who recently passed away, suffered from dementia, and I so wanted to create for my dad a place that would fit his particular personality, a nursing home, that I turned all of that into a short story called Town and Country about a kind of rat pack nursing home. And so the collection feels both more personal to me and also an attempt to expand beyond the personal into all these different kinds of characters.
That's so interesting you said about Town and Country, because you've taken something in your real life and made that the story. That's very touching.
My dad was a lifelong drinker and smoker and lived a hard life, and I would visit these nursing homes as he fell into Alzheimer's, and it was, I just thought, I can't put my dad here, you know, where's he going to get a cocktail, you know, how's he gonna this isn't how he lived his life, why now would he have to go there? And so it was almost a little bit of fantasy at first to imagine there was a place where first of all, the menu is in, you know, 32 point type so they could see, and the prices are from 1978. You know, you could get a meatloaf and a Tom Collins for $6. And just imagining how happy that menu would make my dad used to make me laugh. And so crafting that fictional world around something you wish existed was something I'd never done before.
I love the little detail you put in that these aren't the real prices and you'll be getting the bill like later on. It was just made it so realistic because it just made it so realistic, I think, that moment.
And crushing up blood pressure medicine and putting it in a martini glass so the people would drink it. By the end, I thought there's no way this place should exist. And like often happens with stories, there's a kind of synthesis between inventing the world, inventing these characters, and having some theme come out that you didn't expect. With that one, it being, you know, sort of this, the power of nostalgia and the in many ways insidious kind of destructive power of a simple phrase like "Make America Great Again," you know, returning to a time that never was. And that's what I love about writing stories, is I'll start with the germ of an idea that might be personal like that. Or my mom died of cancer, and so with drafting, for instance, I spent months sort of nursing her and watching the way chemotherapy and radiation wore away her esophagus and just made drinking water so incredibly painful. And so taking things like that and sort of grafting them onto the lives of other characters is a way, you know, to escape that horrible trap of write what you know, and instead taking what you know and imagining it into worlds and lives that are so different from yours, and using what I think is the only real power that a writer has, which is, you know, your empathy, your ability to live outside yourself. Mm.
I think it's a wonderful kind of act of kindness. Like if you're an architect, you might build your parents a house or your children a house. You're a writer, so you can write your father the perfect retirement home. You know, it's a kind of, you know, it's a wonderful gift.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. We actually did find a place where you could have a couple of cigarettes and a couple of beers. And even I remember there was one point where he had really lost the ability to speak. You know, he had fallen so far, and we took him outside and lit up a cigarette, and even forgetting, you know, people and basic things, he still took the cigarette, tapped it down the way he did. My dad would always do this to his lip, run his finger across his lip before he put the cigarette in. We lit it, and he took a deep drag and said, "How are you guys?" The first words he'd spoken in weeks.
Oh, wow.
But it was as if it just triggered the nicotine or something, or even the habit just triggered him being himself for just a moment. And then he was gone again, you know? And so I even think it was kind of therapeutic, you know? And so I really appreciate that. But, you know, if I were an architect, I would have built him a house, and instead I wrote him a short story.
Even though the stories deal with really difficult things, very, very difficult things that are affecting a lot of people, I found myself laughing a lot. I found that there's so much humor in this book. I rarely laugh out loud when reading, especially in public, because I was reading this in a cafe, and I rarely laugh out loud. But some of the bits, especially Angel of Rome, when he takes the script back to his Latin class, and you don't mention it, you just cut straight to it like it's a film, and they're doing it. Like, I'm pissing myself laughing. I just wondering, how do you, writing funny is hard. It's really, really hard. And we've spoken to lots of writers who are funny and they've sort of talked about it. But I wonder if you could, how do you write funny? What do you do to write funny?
I think I think what you asked is, to me, the key to writing funny, which is I start with something sad and dark, and I love the intersection of those things. I think it, you know, without knowing Jack Rigel's specific background and knowing, you know, his sort of haplessness, I love a character like that. The Angel of Rome is probably the most intentionally funny story. Mm-hmm. But without the sort of pathos of his background, it would fall away in farce. And I think that happens to me in writing short stories sometimes that are merely funny, is at the end, I think, I don't care. And I think that laughter is so much richer and deeper when you care, when those characters have, you know, taken purchase in you somewhere. And so that's the first thing, is it has to be a story more grounded in the real things we go through, for me. And then it becomes a kind of audacity and pushing the edge of things and, you know, asking yourself, can I get away with a Latin class at the Vatican becoming a writer's room for a TV show, you know? and if so, can the characters that I've created, you know, pop up in this way that, you know, are hopefully comic. And the other thing that that story had that I think was great fun was the humor of language and of misunderstanding and translation. And I actually had a little handbook, a little phrase book from the first time I went to Italy. And looking through that, for those that don't know the story, Jack Ragel is this young American student who is studying Latin, and he gets mistaken for an Italian speaker and hired by this actor, Ronnie Tower is the character that this actor played in an American TV show, to translate on the set of this Italian movie. And just the, you know, the miscommunications. I'm so glad when I hear people laugh, because I cracked myself up writing, and maybe I shouldn't admit that. Maybe there's a lack of humility there, but it's one of my favorite things when I type something that that I didn't know would come out that way, and it makes me laugh. I also sometimes make myself cry, which is maybe more embarrassing. But you know, I'll get to a point in Myra's story, and I'll just, you know, find myself feeling so much for her that, you know, you just become overwhelmed with that stuff. So I always think if I've cracked myself up, that there's a good chance the reader will follow.
That's amazing. For the reader, Magnificent Desolation, probably the funniest bit in the whole book. I won't ruin it. You have to read it. But that, I was crying with laughter at that. It was just so...
That's one of the rare stories that I sort of imagined the end first. You know, I sort of imagined, and then it becomes, can you cover your tracks enough that this story, that the denouement of this story feels surprising and inevitable?
It did. And that, it definitely did.
I hoped so.
It definitely did.
But I've heard from so many teachers, and the setup to that story is this teacher who has a student who's apparent deep religious beliefs. That, you know, he comes into class and says he doesn't believe anything about science and won't do his homework. And I've had so many teachers tell me that story is exactly what teaching is like. So I think there's just enough verisimilitude in a story like that that you can get away with the humor that comes later.
The BOB podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, we're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount of any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org. I wondered if we could return to The Angel of Rome for a moment. Would you mind talking about the process of writing? Because not only did you write it to be read aloud, but you also wrote it in collaboration with Eduardo Ballerini.
There were a couple stories in here that were written to be read aloud. And another one was Magnificent Desolation. And I tend to read all of my stories aloud. I write them often and then perform them at literary events in Spokane or other places. And so for me, it's a great form. With The Angel of Rome, Eduardo Ballerini had done an amazing job narrating beautiful ruins. And I always joked that I didn't love to listen to audio versions of my books. Because just hearing your writing in someone else's voice sometimes just feels off in some way. The only way I could explain it is that it's like watching a video of someone make out with your wife. No matter how well they do it, it just didn't quite seem right. You know, the language just wasn't in the place as you put it. But when I heard Eduardo do Beautiful Ruins, I just thought, he's bringing something to it that I haven't seen before. We enjoyed that so much. We did a few events together and became friends. And we started talking about our favorite neighborhood in Rome, Trastevere. And he had lived there as a young man. And I said, what were you doing there? And he said, I was studying Latin. And he's very different than a Jess Walter character, though. Eduardo Ballerini is an actor. He's been on The Sopranos and other shows. He's the son of a famous Italian poet, grew up in New York. I could no more write that character than, I could write a being in another galaxy. And so I started thinking of my Latin student as very much more someone like me who grows up in a you know, in a more working class or poorer family. And then just the idea of being in Rome and, you know, being Catholic, that that's sort of where the story went. And then all the Hollywood stuff I just sort of, you know, tacked in. But there were a few images that Eduardo and I shared. Like, we both remembered this feeling of standing outside a restaurant in Europe and looking inside and feeling like on the inside was the whole world. All the beauty and luxury and majesty of Europe was inside that restaurant, and you were just some poor guy walking down the street who happened to glance in. We also strangely both bought leather coats in Italy. Like, I still remember walking in Florence and this salesman on the Ponte Vecchio snapping his fingers and saying I needed to wear it to buy this coat, and the shoulders went all the way over my arms and the sleeves went past the ends of my fingers, but somehow he convinced me it fit perfectly. And every time I put that leather coat on back in the United States, I just felt like such an idiot, like all of my ambitions and aspirations were wrapped up in this coat that didn't fit me. And so there were a few images like that Eduardo and I tossed back and forth. I wrote the story and then flew to New York, and this was the part of the process that I had never done before and was so much fun. And I think made the story funnier, which was we table read it like a play. Since he was going to perform the audio version, he read each of the characters, and I got to sort of fine tune their dialogue in a way that, and this was during the pandemic, and so it was also just amazing to work with another human being at that point, and especially on something like fiction, which we don't tend, you know, to work with. So I still did the writing, but it was very much a collaboration in that way. I thought of writing a sort of craft book for writers of completely unhelpful tips that you could probably never do. One of which is fly to New York and have a famous actor perform your short story. You know, that would be like tip number four, you know, of completely.
I like the idea of that book.
Yeah, completely useless tips. But I do think it underscores something that I've always thought, which is reading your stories aloud is, and performing them, having them performed is an amazing way, you know, to make sure the story works and to, you know, find those lines that really land. And to hear in your own head the way you think the story should sound.
I have a good friend who records herself every single time she writes something and then listens to it back, which which I started doing for a while, but then I don't know, it just takes a long time, doesn't it?
Yeah. It does. And I can usually hear it as I'm reading it, you know, and but I have one of my favorite literary events is actually this week in Spokane. It's our literary festival, Get Lit. And so I'll be reading at the Pie and Whiskey reading. And you may notice that a lot of my stories feature whiskey. And it's often because that's the prompt we get at this event is to write about pie or whiskey. And I tend to just usually choose whiskey. And partly because it's my drink of choice, but so really a great way for me to sort of start. Often I'll just read the germ of a story, the very beginning of it. And then take it away and work on it after that reading.
Can I kind of interject with a question? You mentioned that you love the pie and whiskey nights, and it sounds like there's a kind of a regular group of people that meet. And I was at a talk today at London Book Fair, and there was lots of people talking about the importance of community and writers. And do you think it is important? And do you have a writing community? And kind of can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I do think it's important, especially I think early on when you're starting. And, you know, I don't, in the United States, the classic track for a fiction writer is to go to this university and then go to that grad school and then get a job teaching at that university. And in each of those steps, a community is sort of there. And because I didn't have that, I was a newspaper journalist, I had to sort of look for that sense of community, first in Spokane, which turns out to be a very literary place, and then in a larger way too outside, you know, finding those writers you connect with, and I do think that having a public side of that, I had a friend who was a bartender who would just have a poetry and short story night at his bar, and we would go down and just you know, order an old fashioned and stand up and read a short story. And again, keeping them short, and people would sign up, and there were, you know, and it sort of crossed generations. There'd be 25-year-old college students. And there was, I still remember a surrealist poet who would come in, and he had to be in his 70s and had been, you know, in the literary scene in San Francisco and had read at City Lights and all these places. And I still remember he had this long gray beard, and in the voice of John Huston, he would always stand up and say, "This poem appeared first in the journal Magnificent Fellatio," or something. And it would be, you know, and I had never heard of any of these journals. They had the most outrageous names. Said, "This poem appeared," and then he would read these surrealist poets. And I just loved that these young writers got to see, you know, got to kind of rub shoulders that way. So I do think it's important. I have a group of writer friends here, novelists and short story writers and poets that I've shared work with all the time. And then, you know, other writers along the way that are just provide a really good sounding board and kind of understand, you know, what the work means and understand the context with which, you know, it's being written. And you can't really expect your spouse or your partner or your significant other to care as much about, you know, whether or not this is more a Alice Munro-like story or a Raymond Carver-like story or, you know, a Stephen Milhauser story. And so to have these friends you can bounce that work off, I think, is so important.
I want to talk about the final story and the character of Jeremiah especially, who espouses hope above everything else at the end of the story. Hope for the world, hope for America, hope for everything. And I felt like the book is actually quite full of hope. There's a lot of hope in the story, a lot of downtrodden, like, characters who are suffering, but somehow at the end they may not come out of it, but they come out of it not unscathed, but maybe new and fresh, and maybe they have a new way of dealing with these things. And I just wondered if you felt that you have a certain obligation as a writer to do that to your stories, or whether you're happy to just let your characters wallow in self-pity and die at the end. I don't know.
I think happy to let them wallow in self-pity is a little bit of an exaggeration, but I definitely found, I think it has more to do. I think the subtext of hope that I do think runs throughout the book had more to do with where I was as a human being, honestly, and less to do with what I thought these stories required. My last collection, We Live in Water, I think you could argue is darker, also very funny, but there's often no exit for the people. They just stay on the on-ramp toward misery. And I think part of it came from teaching young people and at a couple of different teaching stops, and then my own kids, and seeing in this generation a deep cynicism that has, I think, rounded the edges off even them dreaming of doing better. I think, you know, that broke my heart a little bit. In the other book, in We Live in Water, I had a short story that was also sort of post-apocalyptic, and the character made this point: why are we pretending it's the end of the world? If you lived through the Great Depression, through the Holocaust, through the plague, through any of these historical things, you would have thought things were far worse than they are now. Why do we, you know, you think this is the end of the world? This isn't the end of the world. It's always the end of the world. And that was sort of how I was thinking when I wrote that story. When I wrote specifically this story, The Way the World Ends, I was thinking that my kids and the young people I'd come across really don't have a lot of reason for hope. They live in a, you know, in a sort of dark cloud that was heartbreaking for me. And I had to ask myself, do I have any? Where does it come from? And it usually came from other people. And so throughout the collection, whether it's Myra looking for some bit of life in this character Boone, or Jack Riegel finding some way forward by meeting this guy Ronnie Tower, I wanted to provide these unlikely characters from Mr. Voice on, these people who show that you don't have to be someone's real father to be their father. That, you know, your mentor like Jack Rigels can be an egotistical, you know, booze swilling, actress chasing TV star. And in that last story, especially, I wanted the character of Jeremiah to be, you know, to really sort of challenge these Gen X people who have lived their life along a certain code and won't acknowledge the fact that we're all fiddling right while Rome burns. And so creating that challenge was, you know, and asking myself, where would you turn for help? And again, it was one of those moments that was really moving as a writer when he says, you know, I would think to give up hope, you would have done all you can. Have you done all you can? And this adult just says, no, we haven't even started doing all we can. We haven't really done anything yet. And that just stepping back and taking that longer look at the capabilities that we might have to address climate change, to address gun violence in the United States, you know, gave me hope only because of the great room for improvement, I guess. Mm-hmm. I also set out to write that story. It was a writing prompt to write an apocalyptic story about climate change. And I thought, I want it to feel as if you're watching the movie trailer for a post-apocalyptic movie, but it's actually just a story about two professors interviewing for the same job, you know? And so writing in that vein that it was, you know, I was going to have the big dark booms of thunder and the deep voice, you know, in a world where hope has been forgotten, you know, two characters walk against the, you know, I just almost imagine that being the voice of the whole story. And that kind of playfulness, I think, allowed the character of Jeremiah and these two professors, Anna and Rowan, to kind of end up in this, what I thought of as almost like a great play narrated by Johnny Cash, of all things. Mm-hmm. So it was great fun to write, and then to tack on the end to kind of bring home that idea that you find hope in these unlikely characters.
I loved that line, you can only give up hope once you've finished your I think I might have butchered it too.
It's always so better in the characters' voices,
you can only give up hope once you've done all you can. I think it's just that's such a powerful message. It's such a wonderfully powerful message.
Because I did not mean to include messages in my short story
but
collection.
It's such a great thing to tell somebody, I think. And it's a great thing to tell that generation, or our generation, or all generations, that you cannot stop until you've tried everything. And it's such a, it's almost freeing, because it's like, okay, well, now I have to try then, because I can't just wallow in self-pity. I do have to try. And I think that's, you must act.
I happen to be in, that story is set around the first, Pride parade in Starkville, Mississippi, where Mississippi State is, and I happened to be in Mississippi for a huge storm right around the time that Mississippi State University was having its first Pride parade, and so that was roiling campuses. I was there as a visiting writer on campus, and it was only afterward that I went and looked to see how did that parade turn out, that I saw that in this tiny gay and lesbian student club at this very conservative university in the South, where there were only like 17 members or something of this club, and they wanted to put on a parade, and the town rejected their parade, the first time they'd ever rejected a parade. Well, they decided to do it anyway, and to see that some 3,000 or 4,000 people showed up waving, you know, rainbow flags and supporting these students' right to march in this town, it filled me with hope. And so to try to capture that feeling of having been there in this moment, and then transferring that to look how far, you know, Barack Obama could not even admit that he was okay with gay marriage when he ran for president. A few years later, it wasn't even an issue. Most Americans, you know, thought, of course, gay people can get married. Why couldn't they? And just to see that progress that could be made on an issue that seemed to cleave the country just a few years earlier did give me a sort of hope over these other large issues that continue to, you know, befuddle and bedraggle us.
It is hopeful. The change over the last few decades has been remarkable and fast.
And I think sometimes we are so tuned into the moment, especially now with this technology that brings us the news the moment it happens, that we forget to take a step back and say, you know, that progress is made, and it's made, you know, not as fast as maybe we would like, but it is made. So anyway, that was the hopeful way I ended the story. So
I wanted to go back and ask you about, like, listening to you talk about your work, and you say you have a lot of fun writing your work, and you can hear the excitement in your voice as you're describing the process of writing a story. And this, I believe, is your 10th book. Is
yes,
that right? Yeah. Ninth or 10th?
Yeah, hard to believe.
I guess I would like to ask, how do you motivate yourself? What drives you? How do you kind of maintain your momentum over, like, a whole career of writing? It's like, it's a magical thing that you've been able to do.
Oh,
and I guess, like, what advice could you offer for writers for whom writing is not always so fun, or who may be at the beginning of their careers?
You know, and I think that's an important point. I'm at a place now where this is what I do. And so, you know, when I started, it wasn't. I was a newspaper reporter and I had young kids and I had to scratch out time to write. And I think because of that, that writing time became so precious to me and became part meditation, part entertainment, part, you know, when I got to sort of connect with myself and my ambitions and my dreams. And I had dreamed of being a novelist and a short story writer forever. And I seemed so far from it most of my adult life that when I got a chance to do it, it was very much, you know, like part of a daydream. Like, I get to write a short story, and I would read something and try to create those effects in my own words. And the hard thing is your own voice has to develop over that time. And so working on those things. But I think initially it was just that I valued writing time so much that I come from a real working class family. And so I treated it, you know, I did not allow myself to be stopped by writer's block or anything. I just said, I've got a little time to write. I'm going to write. And then an amazing thing, I'm friends with many musicians, and I started noticing not a single one of them ever says they're going to work. They say they're going to play. And I started thinking, there's no difference me sitting down with my journal and with my laptop than them picking up a guitar and starting to strum and writing hooks and song lyrics, and or sitting down at the piano and just trying to get a melody out. And that idea of playing instead of working, I think really animated the writing for me a little bit. And why shouldn't I try to make myself laugh? Why shouldn't I create characters whose paths move me in such a way that, you know, that I'm a little bit weepy at the end? And so I think those two things have motivated me. It really is because it was my daydream. I also have this quality of every time a book comes out, you know, taking it and holding it and sliding it on the bookshelf and feeling connected to my 9-year-old self who, you know, since I couldn't be a pirate, decided I would be a writer. And I think those ways, you know, and most helpful to me lately has been thinking of it in terms of music. You know, I just want to sit down and riff and try to find a song that pleases me and hopefully pleases other people.
Final question for you, Jess, is what are you reading right now? And are there writers or books that you always return to?
What am I reading right now? Fiction wise, I, let's see what I think of what's open in my office right now. I was actually reading another short story collection by a former student of mine named Ada Zhang, which is, her stories are terrific. I get asked to do blurb work quite a bit. There are writers that I return to a lot. I leave stories of theirs. I have the Alice Munro selected short stories, and I love to just read one and then wander away. And it's funny when you write a story collection because you hope readers will read each one and then come back and read the whole book at once. But with some short story writers, and Alice Munro is one, I love to just read one of her stories and then wander off and find myself thinking about it and returning to it in different ways. It's really one of my favorite things. And Dennis Johnson, we talked about earlier, I find myself wanting to go back and read a story and seeing if it does what I thought it did in my memory when I go back to it. Edward P. Jones is another writer who I find myself returning to. All Aunt Hagar's Children is such an amazing collection, and his novel, The Known World. So I find myself going back to that. And then there are certain writers, if they have a new book come out, that that I will be the first in line. Percival Everett is one of those. And so every time a new book of his comes out, I feel like I have to be the first in line to read it.
It's I'm happy to hear you say Percival Everett, because I think people in the UK have only just got him, because Influx Press published him over here quite recently. Yeah.
Oh, did they? Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. He spent a lot of time avoiding fame, but I think it's come for him finally.
I think it has. Yeah. Okay. And I'm also happy you said Alice Munro, because I've got her book right there on the table next to me.
Yeah. Oh, do you? Yeah. Yeah. The way she's able to just create these novelistic stories, and I just marvel at them, and they live in my imagination. We were talking about trains earlier. I can't see a train without imagining a young female Alice Munro character getting on a train headed for some outpost in British Columbia or somewhere in Canada to take a teaching job or to meet her new husband or something. You know, they're just so evocative.
Yeah, they stick with you, don't they? Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a total pleasure.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
To hear you talk about your work, about everything. Thank you very much.
It's just been wonderful.
Yeah, thank you both. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. You can listen to all 15 previous episodes of the BOB podcast. Now, just head to our website, bricklanebookshop.org, or search Brick Lane Bookshop on Spotify or Apple Podcast or wherever you listen. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch by emailing us at inquiries@bricklanebookshop.org or finding us on social media via @bricklanebooks. Thank you for listening. The BOB podcast music is by Andrew Everett. If you like his music as much as we do, you can find more of it on his Bandcamp page. There's a link on our website.